Part 2. The Golden Age. Chapter 8. Cold War. Although Soviet Russia intends to spread her influence by all possible means, world revolution is no longer part of her program, and there is nothing in the internal conditions within the Union which might encourage a return to the old revolutionary traditions. Any comparison between the German menace before the war and a Soviet menace today must allow for fundamental differences. There is, therefore, infinitely less danger of a sudden catastrophe with the Russians than with the Germans. Frank Roberts, British Embassy, Moscow, to Foreign Office, London, 1946. The war economy provides comfortable niches for tens of thousands of bureaucrats in and out of military uniform who go to the office every day to build nuclear weapons or to plan nuclear war. Millions of workers whose jobs depend on the system of nuclear terrorism, scientists and engineers hired to look for that final technological breakthrough that can provide total security, contractors unwilling to give up easy profits, warrior intellectuals who sell threats and bless wars. Richard Barnett. 1. The 45 years from the dropping of the atom bombs to the end of the Soviet Union do not form a single homogeneous period in world history. As we shall see in the following chapters, they fall into two halves, the decades on either side of the watershed of the early 1970s. Nevertheless, the history of the entire period was welded into a single pattern by the peculiar international situation which dominated it until the fall of the USSR, the constant confrontation of the two superpowers which emerged from the Second World War, the so-called Cold War. The Second World War had barely ended when humanity plunged into what can reasonably be regarded as a Third World War, though a very peculiar one. For, as the great philosopher Thomas Hobbes observed, war consisteth not in battle only, or the act of fighting, but in a tract of time wherein the will to contend by battle is sufficiently known. The Cold War between the two camps of the USA and the USSR, which utterly dominated the international scene in the second half of the short 20th century, was unquestionably such a tract of time. Entire generations grew up under the shadow of global nuclear battles, which, it was widely believed, could break out at any moment and devastate humanity. Indeed, even those who did not believe that either side intended to attack the other found it hard not to be pessimistic, since Murphy's Law is one of the most powerful generalizations about human affairs. If it can go wrong, sooner or later it will. As time went on, more and more things were there which could go wrong, both politically and technologically, in a permanent nuclear confrontation, based on the assumption that only the fear of mutually assured destruction, correctly concentrated into the acronym MAD, would prevent one side or the other from giving the ever-ready signal for the planned suicide of civilization. It did not happen, but for some 40 years it looked a daily possibility. The peculiarity of the Cold War was that, speaking objectively, no imminent danger of world war existed. More than this, in spite of the apocalyptic rhetoric on both sides, but especially on the American side, the governments of both the superpowers accepted the global distribution of force at the end of the Second World War, which amounted to a highly uneven but essentially unchallenged balance of power. The USSR controlled or exercised predominant influence in one part of the globe, the zone occupied by the Red Army and or other communist armed forces at the end of the war, and did not attempt to extend its range of influence further by military force. The USA exercised control and predominance over the rest of the capitalist world, as well as the Western Hemisphere and the oceans, taking over what remained of the old imperial hegemony of the former colonial powers. In return, it did not intervene in the zone of accepted Soviet hegemony. In Europe, the demarcation lines had been drawn in 1943 to 1945, both by agreement at various summit meetings between Roosevelt, Churchill and Stalin, and by virtue of the fact that only the Red Army could actually defeat Germany. There were a few uncertainties, notably about Germany and Austria, which were solved by the partition of Germany along the lines of the Eastern and Western occupation forces, and the withdrawal of all ex-belligerents from Austria. The latter became a sort of second Switzerland, a small country committed to neutrality, envied for its persistent prosperity, and therefore described correctly as boring. The USSR accepted West Berlin as a Western enclave inside its German territory with reluctance, but was not prepared to fight the issue. The situation outside Europe was less clear-cut, except for Japan, where the USA, from the start, established a completely unilateral occupation that excluded not only the USSR, but any other co-belligerent. The problem was that the end of the old colonial empires was predictable, and indeed in 1945 plainly imminent on the Asian continent, but the future orientation of the new post-colonial states was by no means clear. As we shall see, this was the zone in which the two superpowers continued throughout the Cold War to compete for support and influence, and hence the major zone of friction between them, and indeed the one where armed conflict was most likely and actually broke out. Unlike Europe, not even the limits of the area under future communist control could be predicted, let alone agreed by negotiation in advance, however provisionally and ambiguously. Thus, the USSR did not much want a communist takeover in China, but it took place nevertheless. However, in what soon came to be called the Third World, the conditions for international stability began to emerge within a few years, as it became clear that most of the new post-colonial states, however unsympathetic to the USA and its camp, were non-communist, indeed mostly anti-communist in their domestic politics, and non-aligned, that is to say, outside the Soviet military bloc in international affairs. In short, the communist camp showed no sign of significant expansion between the Chinese Revolution and the 1970s, by which time communist China was no longer in it. In effect, the world situation became reasonably stable soon after the war and remained so until the middle 1970s, when the international system and its component units entered another period of lengthy political and economic crisis. Until then, both the superpowers accepted the uneven division of the world, made every effort to settle demarcation disputes without an open clash between their armed forces that might lead to a war between them, and, contrary to ideology and Cold War rhetoric, worked on the assumption that long-term peaceful coexistence between them was possible. Indeed, when it came to the point, both trusted one another's moderation, even at times when they were officially on the brink of, or even engaged in, war. Thus, during the Korean War of 1950 to 1953, in which the Americans were officially involved, but not the Russians, Washington knew perfectly well that up to 150 Chinese planes were actually Soviet planes flown by Soviet pilots. The information was kept dark because it was correctly assumed that the last thing Moscow wanted was war. During the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, as we now know, the main concern on both sides was how to prevent warlike gestures from being misinterpreted as actual moves to war. Until the 1970s, this tacit agreement to treat the Cold War as a cold peace held good. The USSR knew, or rather learned as early as 1953, that the US calls to roll back communism were mere radio histrionics when Soviet tanks were quietly allowed to re-establish communist control against a serious working-class revolt in East Germany. From then on, as the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 confirmed, the West would keep out of the region of Soviet domination. The Cold War that actually tried to live up to its own rhetoric of a struggle for supremacy or annihilation was not the one in which basic decisions were taken by governments, but the shadowy contest between their various acknowledged and unacknowledged secret services, which in the West produced that most characteristic spin-off of the international tension, the fiction of espionage and covert killing. In this genre, the British, through Ian Fleming's James Bond and John le Carré's Sour Sweet Heroes, both had served their time in the British Secret Services, maintained a steady superiority, thus compensating for their country's decline in the world of real power. However, except in some of the weaker countries of the Third World, the operations of KGB, CIA and their like were trivial in terms of real power politics, though often dramatic. Was there, under these circumstances, a real danger of world war at any time during this long period of tension, except, of course, by the sort of accident which inevitably threatens those who skate long enough on sufficiently thin ice? It is hard to say. Probably the most explosive period was that between the formal enunciation of the Truman Doctrine in March 1947, I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures, and April 1951, when the same US president dismissed General Douglas MacArthur, commander of the US forces in the Korean War, 1950 to 1953, who pushed military ambition too far. This was the period when the American fear of social disintegration or revolution within the non-Soviet parts of Eurasia were not wholly fantastic. After all, in 1949, the communists took over China. Conversely, the USSR found itself faced with a US which enjoyed the monopoly of nuclear arms and multiplied militant and threatening declarations of anti-communism, while the first cracks appeared in the solidity of the Soviet bloc as Tito's Yugoslavia broke away, 1948. Moreover, from 1949 on, China was under a government which did not merely plunge readily into a major war in Korea, but, unlike all other governments, was willing to envisage actually fighting and surviving a nuclear holocaust. Anything might happen. Once the USSR acquired nuclear weapons, 4 years after Hiroshima in the case of the atom bomb, 1949, 9 months after the USA in the case of the hydrogen bomb, 1953, both superpowers plainly abandoned war as an instrument of policy against one another, since it was the equivalent of a suicide pact. Whether they seriously envisaged nuclear action against third parties, the USA in Korea in 1951, and to save the French in Vietnam in 1954, the USSR against China in 1969, is not quite clear, but in any case, the weapons were not used. However, both used the nuclear threat, almost certainly without intending to carry it out, on some occasions. The USA to speed peace negotiations in Korea and Vietnam, 1953-1954. The USSR to force Britain and France to withdraw from Suez in 1956. Unfortunately, the very certainty that neither superpower would actually want to press the nuclear button tempted both sides into using nuclear gesticulation for purposes of negotiation, or in the USA, for domestic politics, confident that the other did not want war either. This confidence proved justified, but at the cost of racking the nerves of generations. The Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, an entirely unnecessary exercise of this kind, almost plunged the world into an unnecessary war for a few days, and actually frightened even the top decision-makers into rationality for a while. 2. How then are we to explain the 40 years of an armed and mobilized confrontation, based on the always implausible, and in this case plainly baseless assumption, that the globe was so unstable that a world war might break out at any moment and was held at bay only by unceasing mutual deterrence? In the first instance, the Cold War was based on a Western belief, absurd in retrospect, but natural enough in the aftermath of the Second World War, that the age of catastrophe was by no means at an end, that the future of world capitalism and liberal society was far from assured. Most observers expected a serious post-war economic crisis, even in the USA, on the analogy of what had happened after the First World War. A future Nobel Prize economist in 1943 spoke of the possibility in the USA of the greatest period of unemployment and industrial dislocation which any economy has ever faced. Indeed, the post-war plans of the US government were far more concretely concerned with preventing another great slump than with preventing another war, a matter to which Washington gave only divided and provisional attention before victory. If Washington expected the great post-war troubles, which undermined stability, social, political, and economic, in the world, it was because at the end of the war the belligerent countries, with the exception of the USA, were a field of ruins inhabited by what seemed to Americans hungry, desperate, and probably radicalized peoples, only too ready to listen to the appeal of social revolution and economic policies incompatible with the international system of free enterprise, free trade, and investment by which the USA and the world were to be saved. Moreover, the pre-war international system had collapsed, leaving the USA facing an enormously strengthened communist USSR across large stretches of Europe and even vaster stretches of the non-European world, whose political future seemed quite uncertain, except that in this explosive and unstable world, anything that happened was more likely than not to weaken both capitalism and the USA, and to strengthen the power which had come into existence by and for revolution. The immediate post-war situation in many of the liberated and occupied countries seemed to undermine the situation of moderate politicians with little to support them except the Western allies, and beset within and outside their governments by the communists, who emerged from the war everywhere far stronger than at any time in the past, and sometimes as the largest parties and electoral forces of their countries. The socialist premier of France came to Washington to warn that, without economic support, he was likely to fall to the communists. The terrible harvest of 1946, followed by the appalling winter of 1946-47, made both European politicians and American presidential advisers even more nervous. Under the circumstances, it is not surprising that the wartime alliance between the major capitalist and the socialist power now at the head of its own zone of influence should have broken down, as even less heterogeneous coalitions so often do at the end of wars. However, this is clearly not enough to explain why US policy, Washington's allies and clients, with the possible exception of Britain, were considerably less overheated, should have been based, at least in its public statements, on a nightmare scenario of the Muscovite superpower poised for the immediate conquest of the globe and directing a godless, communist world conspiracy ever ready to overthrow the realms of freedom. It is even more inadequate to explain the campaign rhetoric of a J.F. Kennedy in 1960 at a time when what the British Premier Harold Macmillan called our modern free society, the new form of capitalism, could not conceivably have been said to be in any immediate trouble. Why could the outlook of the State Department professionals in the aftermath of the war be described as apocalyptic? Why did even the calm British diplomat, who rejected any comparison of the USSR with Nazi Germany, then report from Moscow that the world was now faced with the danger of a modern equivalent of the religious wars of the 16th century, in which Soviet communism will struggle with Western social democracy and the American version of capitalism for domination of the world? For it is now evident, and was reasonably probable even in 1945 to 1947, that the USSR was neither expansionist, still less aggressive, nor counting on any further extension of the communist advance beyond what is assumed had been agreed at the summits of 1943-1945. Indeed, where Moscow controlled its client regimes and communist movements, these were specifically committed to not building states on the model of the USSR, but mixed economies under multi-party parliamentary democracies, which were specifically distinguished from the dictatorship of the proletariat and still more of a single party. These were described in inner party documents as neither useful nor necessary. The only communist regimes that refused to follow this line were those whose revolutions, actively discouraged by Stalin, escaped from Moscow's control, for example, Yugoslavia. Moreover, though this has not been much noticed, the Soviet Union demobilized its troops, its major military asset, almost as fast as the USA, reducing the Red Army from a 1945 peak strength of almost 12 millions to 3 millions by late 1948. On any rational assessment, the USSR presented no immediate danger to anyone outside the reach of the Red Army's occupation forces. It emerged from war in ruins, drained and exhausted, its peacetime economy in shreds, its government distrustful of a population, much of which, outside Great Russia, had shown a distinct and understandable lack of commitment to the regime. On its western fringe, it continued to have trouble with Ukrainian and other nationalist guerrillas for some years. It was ruled by a dictator who had demonstrated that he was as risk-averse outside the territory he controlled directly as he was ruthless within it, J.V. Stalin. It needed all the economic aid it could get, and therefore had no short-term interest in antagonizing the only power that could give it, the USA. No doubt Stalin, as a communist, believed that capitalism would inevitably be replaced by communism, and to this extent any coexistence of the two systems would not be permanent. However, Soviet planners did not see capitalism as such in crisis at the end of the Second World War. They had no doubt that it would continue for a long time under the hegemony of the USA, whose enormously increased wealth and power was only too obvious. That, in fact, is what the USSR suspected and was afraid of. Its basic posture after the war was not aggressive, but defensive. However, a policy of confrontation on both sides arose out of their situation. The USSR, conscious of the precariousness and insecurity of its position, faced the world power of the USA, conscious of the precariousness and insecurity of Central and Western Europe and the uncertain future of much of Asia. Confrontation would probably have developed even without ideology. George Kennan, the American diplomat, who in early 1946 formulated the containment policy, which Washington adopted with enthusiasm, did not believe that Russia was crusading for communism, and, as his subsequent career proved, was far from an ideological crusader, except possibly against democratic politics, of which he had a low opinion. He was merely an able Russian expert of the old school of diplomatic power politics. There were many such in European foreign offices who saw Russia, Tsarist or Bolshevik, as a backward and barbarous society ruled by men moved by a traditional and instinctive Russian sense of insecurity, always cutting itself off from the outside world, always under autocrats, always seeking security, only in patient and deadly struggle for total destruction of rival power, never in compacts and compromises with it, always, consequently, responding only to the logic of force, never to reason. Communism, of course, in his opinion, made the old Russia more dangerous by reinforcing the most brutal of great powers with the most ruthless of utopian, that is to say, world-conquering ideologies. But the implication of the thesis was that the only rival power to Russia's, namely the USA, would have had to contain its pressure by uncompromising resistance, even if it had not been communist. Conversely, from Moscow's point of view, the only rational strategy for defending and exploiting a vast but fragile new position of international power was exactly the same: no compromise. Nobody knew better than Stalin how weak a hand he had to play. There could be no negotiation on the positions offered by Roosevelt and Churchill at the time when the Soviet effort was essential to defeat Hitler and was still believed to be essential to defeat Japan. The USSR might be ready to retreat from any exposed position beyond that fortified by what it considered to have been agreed at the summit meetings of 1943 to 1945, and especially Yalta, for instance, on the borders of Iran and Turkey in 1945-1946, but any attempt to reopen Yalta could only be met by a flat refusal. Indeed, the no of Stalin's foreign minister, Molotov, at all international meetings after Yalta became notorious. The Americans had the power, though only just. Until December 1947, there were no planes to transport the 12 available atom bombs or military capable of assembling them. The USSR had not. Washington would give nothing away except against concessions, but these were precisely what Moscow could not afford to make, even in return for desperately needed economic aid, which in any case the Americans did not want to give them, claiming to have mislaid the Soviet request for a post-war loan made before Yalta. In short, while the USA was worried about the danger of a possible Soviet world supremacy sometime in the future, Moscow was worried about the actual hegemony of the USA now over all parts of the globe not occupied by the Red Army. It would not take much to turn an exhausted and impoverished USSR into yet another client region of the US economy, stronger at the time than all the rest of the world put together. Intransigence was the logical tactic. Let them call Moscow's bluff. Yet the politics of mutual intransigence, even of permanent power rivalry, do not imply the daily danger of war. 19th century British foreign secretaries, who took it for granted that the expansionist urges of Tsarist Russia must be continuously contained in a Kennanite manner, knew perfectly well that moments of open confrontation were rare and war crises even rarer. Still less does mutual intransigence imply the politics of life or death struggle or religious war. However, two elements in the situation helped to move confrontation from the realm of reason to that of emotion. Like the USSR, the USA was a power representing an ideology, which most Americans sincerely believed to be the model for the world. Unlike the USSR, the USA was a democracy. Unfortunately, it must be said that the second of these was probably the more dangerous. For the Soviet government, though it also demonized the global antagonist, did not have to bother about winning votes in Congress or in presidential and congressional elections. The US government did. For both purposes, an apocalyptic anti-communism was useful, and therefore tempting, even for politicians who were not sincerely convinced of their own rhetoric, or like President Truman's Secretary of State for the Navy, James Forstall, 1882 to 1949, clinically mad enough to commit suicide because he saw the Russians coming from his window in the hospital. An external enemy who threatened the USA was convenient for American governments, which had concluded, correctly, that the USA was now a world power, in fact, the greatest world power by far, and which still saw isolationism or a defensive protectionism as its major domestic obstacle. If America itself was not safe, then there could be no withdrawal from the responsibilities and rewards of world leadership, as after the First World War. More concretely, public hysteria made it easier for presidents to raise the vast sums required for American policy from a citizenry notorious for its disinclination to pay taxes. And anti-communism was genuinely and viscerally popular in a country built on individualism and private enterprise, where the nation itself was defined in exclusively ideological terms, Americanism, which could be virtually defined as the polar opposite of communism. Nor should we forget the votes of immigrants from the Sovietized Eastern Europe. It was not the American government which initiated the squalid and irrational frenzy of the anti-red witch hunt, but otherwise insignificant demagogues, some of them, like the notorious Senator Joseph McCarthy, not even particularly anti-communist, who discovered the political potential of wholesale denunciation of the enemy within. The bureaucratic potential had long since been discovered by J. Edgar Hoover, 1895 to 1972, the virtually irremovable chief of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, FBI. What one of the main architects of the Cold War called the attack of the primitives both facilitated and constrained Washington policy by pushing it to extremes, especially in the years following the victory of the communists in China, for which Moscow was naturally blamed. At the same time, the schizoid demand of the vote-sensitive politicians for a policy that should both roll back the tide of communist aggression, save money, and interfere as little as possible with Americans' comfort, committed Washington, and with it the rest of the alliance, not only to an essentially nuclear strategy of bombs rather than men, but to the ominous strategy of massive retaliation announced in 1954. The potential aggressor was to be threatened with nuclear weapons, even in the case of a limited conventional attack. In short, the USA found itself committed to an aggressive stance with minimal tactical flexibility. Both sides thus found themselves committed to an insane arms race to mutual destruction and to the sort of nuclear generals and nuclear intellectuals whose profession required them not to notice this insanity. Both also found themselves committed to what the retiring President Eisenhower, a moderate military man of the old school who found himself presiding over this descent into lunacy without being quite infected by it, called the military-industrial complex, that is to say, the increasingly vast agglomeration of men and resources which lived by the preparation of war. It was a larger vested interest than ever before in times of stable peace between the powers. As might be expected, both military-industrial complexes were encouraged by their governments to use their excess capacity to attract and arm allies and clients, and, not least, to win profitable export markets, while keeping their most up-to-date armaments to themselves, and, of course, their nuclear weapons. For in practice, the superpowers retained their nuclear monopoly. The British acquired bombs of their own in 1952, ironically with the object of lessening their dependence on the USA. The French, whose nuclear arsenal was actually independent of the USA, and the Chinese in the 1960s. While the Cold War lasted, none of these counted. In the course of the 1970s and 1980s, some other countries acquired the capacity to make nuclear weapons, notably Israel, South Africa, and probably India. But such nuclear proliferation did not become a serious international problem until after the end of the bipolar superpower world order in 1989. So who was responsible for the Cold War? Since the debate on this question was for long an ideological tennis match between those who put the blame exclusively on the USSR and the, mainly it must be said, American dissidents who said it was primarily the fault of the USA, it is tempting to join the historical mediators, who put it down to mutual fear escalating from confrontation until the two armed camps began to mobilize under their two opposing banners. This is plainly true, but it is not the whole truth. It explains what has been called the congealing of the fronts in 1947 to 1949, the step-by-step partition of Germany from 1947 to the building of the Berlin Wall in 1961, the failure of the anti-communists on the western side to avoid complete involvement in the US-dominated military alliance, except for General de Gaulle in France, and the failure of those on the eastern side of the divide to escape complete subordination to Moscow, except for Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia. But it does not explain the apocalyptic tone of the Cold War. That came from America. All Western European governments, with or without large communist parties, were without exception wholeheartedly anti-communist and determined to protect themselves against possible Soviet military attack. None would have hesitated if asked to choose between the USA and the USSR, even those committed by history, policy, or negotiation to neutrality. Yet the communist world conspiracy was not a serious part of the domestic politics of any of those who had some claim to being political democracies, at least after the immediate post-war years. Among democratic countries, it was only in the USA that presidents were elected, like John F. Kennedy in 1960, against communism, which in terms of domestic politics was as insignificant in that country as Buddhism in Ireland. If anyone put the crusading element into the realpolitik of international power confrontation and kept it there, it was Washington. In fact, as the rhetoric of J.F. Kennedy's electioneering demonstrates with the clarity of good oratory, the issue was not the academic threat of communist world domination, but the maintenance of a real U.S. supremacy. It must, however, be added that governments of the NATO alliance, though far from happy about American policy, were ready to accept American supremacy as the price of protection against the military power of an abhorrent political system, while that system continued in existence. They were as unprepared as Washington to trust the USSR. In short, containment was everyone's policy. The destruction of communism was not. 3. Though the most obvious face of the Cold War was military confrontation and an ever more frenetic nuclear arms race in the West, this was not its major impact. The nuclear arms were not used. Nuclear powers engaged in three major wars, but not against each other. Shaken by the communist victory in China, the US and its allies, disguised as the United Nations, intervened in Korea in 1950 to prevent the communist regime in the north of that divided country from spreading to the south. The result was a draw. They did so again with the same object in Vietnam, and lost. The USSR withdrew in 1988 after 8 years of providing military support for a friendly government in Afghanistan against American-backed and Pakistan-supplied guerrillas. In short, the expensive high-technology hardware of superpower competition proved indecisive. The constant threat of war produced international peace movements, essentially directed against nuclear arms, which from time to time became mass movements in parts of Europe and were regarded by the Cold War crusaders as secret weapons of the communists. The movements for nuclear disarmament were not decisive either. Although a specific anti-war movement, that of young Americans against being conscripted for the Vietnam War, 1965 to 1975, proved more effective. At the end of the Cold War, these movements left behind a memory of good causes and some curious peripheral relics, such as the adoption of the anti-nuclear logo by the post-1968 countercultures and an ingrained prejudice among environmentalists against any kind of nuclear energy. Much more obvious were the political consequences of the Cold War. Almost immediately, it polarized the world controlled by the superpowers into two sharply divided camps. The governments of national anti-fascist unity, which had led all Europe out of the war, except significantly the three main belligerent states, USSR, USA and Britain, split into homogeneous pro-communist and anti-communist regimes in 1947-1948. In the West, the communists disappeared from governments to become permanent political outcasts. The USA planned military intervention if they won the 1948 elections in Italy. The USSR followed suit by eliminating the non-communists from their multi-party people's democracies, which were henceforth reclassified as dictatorships of the proletariat, that is to say, of the communist parties. A curiously restricted and Eurocentric Communist International, the Cominform, or Communist Information Bureau, was set up to confront the USA, but quietly dissolved in 1956 when international temperatures had cooled. Direct Soviet control was firmly clamped on all of Eastern Europe, except, oddly enough, Finland, which was at the Soviets' mercy and dropped its strong Communist Party from its government in 1948. Why Stalin refrained from installing a satellite government there remains obscure. Perhaps the high probability that the Finns would once again take up arms, as they had done in 1939-1940 and 1941-44, dissuaded him, for he certainly did not want to run the risk of a war that might get out of hand. He tried but failed to impose Soviet control on Tito's Yugoslavia, which consequently broke with Moscow in 1948 without joining the other side. The politics of the communist bloc were henceforth predictably monolithic, although the brittleness of the monolith became increasingly obvious after 1956. The politics of the US-aligned states of Europe were less monochromatic, since virtually all local parties, except the communists, were united in their dislike of the Soviets. In terms of foreign policy, it did not matter who was in office. However, the USA simplified matters in two ex-enemy countries, Japan and Italy, by creating what amounted to a permanent single-party system. In Tokyo, it encouraged the foundation of the Liberal Democratic Party, 1955, and in Italy, by insisting on the total exclusion of the Natural Opposition Party from power because it happened to be communist, it handed the country over to the Christian Democrats, supplemented, as occasion required, by a selection of dwarf parties, liberals, republicans, and so on. From the early 1960s, the only other party of substance, the Socialists, joined the government coalition, having disengaged themselves from a long alliance with the Communists after 1956. The consequence in both these countries was both to stabilise the Communists, in Japan the Socialists, as the major party of opposition, and to install a government regime of institutional corruption on a scale so sensational that, when finally revealed in 1992-93, it shocked even the Italians and Japanese. Both government and opposition, thus frozen into immobility, collapsed with the superpower balance that had kept it in being. Although the USA soon reversed the reforming anti-monopolist policies which its Rooseveltian advisers had initially imposed on occupied Germany and Japan, fortunately for the peace of mind of America's allies, the war had eliminated National Socialism, fascism, overt Japanese nationalism, and much of the right-wing and nationalist sector of the political spectrum from the acceptable public scene. It was therefore impossible as yet to mobilise these unquestionably effective anti-communist elements for the struggle of the free world against totalitarianism, as the restored German big business corporations and the Japanese zaibatsu could be. The political base of Western Cold War governments therefore ranged from the pre-war social democratic left to the pre-war moderate non-nationalist right. Here, the parties linked to the Catholic Church proved particularly useful, since the anti-communist and conservative credentials of the Church were second to none, but its Christian Democratic parties had both a solid anti-fascist record and a non-socialist social programme. These parties thus played a central role in Western politics after 1945, temporarily in France, more permanently in Germany, Italy, Belgium and Austria. However, the effect of the Cold War on the international politics of Europe was more striking than on the continent's domestic politics. It created the European Community, with all its problems, an entirely unprecedented form of political organisation, namely a permanent, or at least a long-lasting, arrangement to integrate the economies, and to some extent the legal systems, of a number of independent nation-states. Initially, 1957, formed by six states, France, the German Federal Republic, Italy, the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg, by the end of the short 20th century, when the system began to totter, like all other products of the Cold War, it had been joined by another six, Britain, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Denmark, Greece, and was in theory committed to even closer political as well as economic integration. This was to lead to permanent federal or confederal political union for Europe. The community was, like so many other things in post-1945 Europe, created both by and against the USA. It illustrates both the power and ambiguity of that country and its limits, but it also illustrates the strength of the fears that held the anti-Soviet alliance together. These were not only fears of the USA. So far as France was concerned, Germany remained the chief danger, and the fear of a revived giant power in Central Europe was shared to a lesser extent by the other ex-belligerent or occupied states of Europe, all of whom now found themselves locked into the NATO alliance with both the USA and an economically revived and rearmed Germany, though fortunately a truncated one. There were also, of course, fears of the USA, an indispensable ally against the USSR, but a suspect because unreliable one, not to mention one which, not surprisingly, was apt to put the interests of the American world supremacy above all else, including those of America's allies. One must not forget that in all the calculations about the post-war world and in all post-war decisions, the premise of all policymakers was American economic preeminence. Fortunately for America's allies, the West European situation in 1946-47 seemed so tense that Washington felt that the development of a strong European and, a little later, a strong Japanese economy was the most urgent priority, and the Marshall Plan, a massive design for European recovery, was launched accordingly in June 1947. Unlike earlier aid, which was clearly part of aggressive economic diplomacy, it mostly took the form of grants rather than loans. Again, fortunately for them, the original American plan for a post-war world economy of free trade, free convertibility and free markets, dominated by the USA, proved quite unrealistic, if only because the desperate payments difficulties of Europe and Japan, thirsting for ever scarcer dollars, meant that there was no immediate prospect for liberalizing trade and payments. Nor was the US in a position to impose on the European states its ideal of a single European plan, preferably leading to a single Europe modelled on the USA in its political structure as well as in its flourishing free enterprise economy. Neither the British, who still saw themselves as a world power, nor the French, who dreamed of a strong France and a weak and partitioned Germany, liked it. However, for the Americans, an effectively restored Europe, part of the anti-Soviet military alliance, which was the logical complement of the Marshall Plan, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, of 1949, had realistically to rest on a German economic strength reinforced by German rearmament. The best the French could do was to so entangle West German and French affairs that conflict between the two old adversaries would be impossible. The French therefore proposed their own version of European Union, the European Coal and Steel Community, 1950, which developed into the European Economic Community, or Common Market, 1957, later simply the European Community, and from 1993, European Union. Its headquarters were in Brussels, but Franco-German unity was its core. The European Community was established as an alternative to the US plan for European integration. Once again, the end of the Cold War was to undermine the foundation on which the European Community and the Franco-German partnership had been built, not least by unbalancing both through the German reunification of 1990 and the unpredicted economic troubles it brought. However, even though the USA was unable to impose its politico-economic plans on the Europeans in detail, it was strong enough to dominate their international behaviour. The policy of the alliance against the USSR was the USA's, and so were its military plans. Germany was rearmed, hankerings after European neutralism were firmly suppressed, and the only attempt by Western powers to engage in a world policy independent of the USA's, namely the Anglo-French Suez War against Egypt of 1956, was aborted under American pressure. The most that an allied or client state could allow itself to do was to refuse complete integration into the military alliance without actually leaving it, like General de Gaulle. And yet, as the Cold War era stretched out, there was a growing gap between the overwhelming military and therefore political domination of the alliance by Washington and the USA's gradually weakening economic predominance. The economic weight of the world economy was now shifting from the USA to the European and Japanese economies, which the USA felt it had rescued and rebuilt. The dollars, so scarce in 1947, had flowed out of the USA in a growing torrent, accelerated, especially in the 1960s, by the American penchant for deficit financing of the enormous costs of their global military activities, notably the Vietnam War after 1965, as well as the most ambitious social welfare program in US history. The dollar, keystone of the post-war world economy, planned and guaranteed by the USA, grew weaker. In theory, backed by the bullion of Fort Knox, which had held almost three-quarters of the world's gold reserves, in practice it consisted increasingly of floods of paper or book entries. But since the stability of the dollar was guaranteed by its link to a given quantity of gold, cautious Europeans, headed by the ultra-cautious and bullion-minded French, preferred to exchange potentially devalued paper for solid ingots. Gold, therefore, poured out of Fort Knox, its price rising as the demand for it rose. For most of the 60s, the stability of the dollar, and with it of the international payment system, was no longer based on the USA's own reserves, but on the willingness of European central banks, under US pressure, not to cash in their dollars for gold and to join in a gold pool to stabilize the price of gold in the market. It did not last. In 1968, the gold pool, now drained, was dissolved. De facto, the convertibility of the dollar ended. It was formally abandoned in August 1971, and with it the stability of the international payments system and its control by the USA or any other single national economy came to an end. When the Cold War ended, so little was left of the US economic hegemony that even the military hegemony could no longer be financed out of the country's own resources. The 1991 Gulf War against Iraq, an essentially US military operation, was paid for, willingly or reluctantly, by other countries which supported Washington. This was one of the rare wars out of which a major power actually made a profit. Fortunately for everyone concerned, except the unhappy inhabitants of Iraq, it was over within a matter of days.